Welcome to the New York Sky Astronomy Seminar for 2021, August 20. And I be John Pasmino. Our topic today is Saturn in 2021. This is the second of a set of three covering the evening planets this year. The first was Venus, which was our last session, and our next one will cover Jupiter. Make sure you have both files, audio and video, for this session. Visit www.nyskies.org. In the jump words at the top of the home page is audio video files. That page, when you click on that one, that page, AV files page, explains how the two audio and video files work the presentation. It also tells you about the New York Skies email group, where you can engage in astronomy with the other members and ask questions and pose comments regarding the session. The session files are at the bottom of this page, and the ones for today are titled Saturn in 2021. The MPEG-3 file, which you're listening to, is the audio. The PPT file is the video one with the slideshow on it. For the Venus show, we had a question for you, and I did get a lot of responses, maybe more than any other that I can recall. I asked, if you look at that slide 17 or 18 in the Venus lesson, they were scenes for the greatest elongation in the evening, east elongation of Venus. I asked, what was the oldest moon that can have a conjunction with Venus? Of course, Venus can have any elongation between 0 and 47, and the moon, therefore, could have any age between 0, that's new moon, and something or other which you had to work out. And about a dozen responses came in, all with pretty much the same result, somewhere between 3 days and 18 hours, and 3 days and 23 hours, because of the method you used. The most common, 1/2 degree per hour, which you know from your lunar observing or occultation work. So 1/2 degree per hour over the 47 degree maximum elongation gives you 94 hours, which is 3 days and 22 hours. That's okay. Other less refined methods gave 3 days, 18 hours or 19 hours, and a tighter calculation gave 3 days and 23 hours. So anything between 3 days, 18 hour, and 3 day, 23 hour is good. You got the right answer, and I'm pretty proud of you in this audience. Okay, if you have the video file, fire it up and set to slide one. This is the title slide. It summarizes the AV files page, but also gives supplemental reading. The first file, I'm just going to give the file name, forgetting the stuff before the last slash, satrings.htm, is a technical explanation of the ring tilt of Saturn, showing the mechanism by which we observe the rings from different angles as the Saturn globe and rings appear to oscillate from full north side, edge on, full south side, edge on, and so on. The next one, 1956-2015.htm, those are years, 1956 to 2015, give a way to use Jupiter and Saturn as lifespan markers for your astronomy career. 1956 was when I first cognizantly identified Jupiter and Saturn in the sky. In 2015 was when Jupiter and Saturn were in the same respective constellations again, and that's 5 Jupiter years and 2 Saturn years. So I think you have a lot of fun with that article. The last one, Juice Box, is a peculiar one. It refers to a workshop that I and others attended a few years ago with a very visual and concrete way to simulate gravity on other planets. And with the school year coming, some may have already started, but most start in September, you may want to use that article plus a bunch of props, which are explained in the article, to give you a physical appreciation of how things weigh when on the surface of other planets. I put it here because the heaviest weights are on Jupiter, and Jupiter is our next session, and then Saturn also makes things pretty heavy, and so you have there an extreme of weight on other worlds, and of course we have it for the other planets also. So let's move on to slide 2. Okay, a physical model with globes representing the outer gaseous Jovian planets. Okay, people ask me, well, Jupiter is the planet, why not Jupiterian or Jupiterel planets? And here you have to play the classicist role. Jupiter is the nominative or subjective or dictionary word for the god Jupiter. But for other uses in the sentences, the stem is J-O-V, Victor, and the adjective form is Jovianus. So for jovial, they're a happy, jolly fellow, by Jove, a mild appellation to the gods. Jovian could mean big, humongous, that's a word, but Jovian is the word when you combine form for Jupiter. And then on the right is Saturn without the rings. The blue balls under them are Uranus and Neptune, also gas planets. And then on the bottom are several of the terrestrial planets, including the Earth. Okay, moving to slide 3. This is a table of facts and figures, also taken from NASA. It complements the one for the inner planets in the Venus lessons. You may want to print this and also the corresponding slide from Venus and keep them on a cardboard sheet for ready reference. If you look down near the bottom where it says satellites, you see the huge number of moons that these outer planets have. Almost all of them, the bulk of them, the majority, were discovered by space probe visits to these planets. I grew up in the elders of our generation, and Jupiter had 16 moons, and Saturn had 9. And it was a test of memory to name all of the Saturn moons. They had names. The Jupiter moons were a little different, and we'll see that better in the Jupiter lesson. But a correct answer would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 14, 15, 16. But I'll show you that in the Jupiter lesson. The inner ones, or the brighter ones of Saturn, are visible in small scopes, and I got a nice picture showing their deployment around the globe. Moving on to slide 4. Okay. The geocentric model of the solar system, this is the complement to the one for the inner planets in the Venus session. And I put it in here to show the retrograde loop mechanism caused by the epicycle, the little subsidiary circle that runs around the main orbit that circles the Earth. When the planet is on the Earth side of the epicycle, it's going through the retrograde loop, and when it's on the lateral or far higher side, it's running directly along through the zodiac. The geocentric model, I remind, did not specify the order of the planets. They are shown here in their traditional sequence: Mercury, Venus, Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, which were doped out by speculation, philosophically, emotion, tradition, and so on. In the geocentric model, which was a calculation algorithm, all the planets ran in a main circle, the deferent of radius 1. And the epicycle was a certain fraction of that radius, and the speed of the planet within the epicycle, they were adjusted to mimic the movement of the planet in the sky without regard to how far away the planets were or the angular size, because these were totally unknown in the pre-telescopic era. In slide 5, we have the solar system out to Saturn, and one of the things that the heliocentric system did, besides moving the Sun to the center with the planets orbiting it, the sizes or the radii of the orbits were now locked into fixed amounts or sizes. So the inner planets really are bunched together down there where it says Earth, whereas Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn are kind of sprawled out well beyond the inner planets. This actually was an argument against heliocentric model, because why would the cosmos be built with so much empty space at a time when the planets were simply points of light There we go. Copernicus lived and flourished in the pre-telescopic era. So you couldn't even say you needed all that room so the globes of the planets don't swap paint. No. But that is it. When you put the sun in the center, the ratio of the epicycle to the main orbit ends up being mapped to the real sun-centered orbits of the planets. We see that in the next slide. 6. Okay. Jupiter and Saturn this year bang around in Copernicus and Aquarius, and in the evening hours at nightfall they're both visible about 15-20 degrees apart in the southeast, Jupiter being the one on the left and the brighter, and Saturn on the right being somewhat dimmer. And they'll stay in those two constellations for the rest of their apparition until by year end in January they leave us in evening twilight. They both are in their retrograde loops right now in August because the opposition of Jupiter was on August, I'm sorry, the opposition of Jupiter in August is on the 20th, and that for Saturn is on the 2nd. So while I'm narrating this, the planets have just passed for Saturn, or is on the cusp of, for Jupiter, their oppositions, but both are racing westward through their retrograde loop. The inset in the right shows the lines of sight from the Earth to Jupiter and Saturn, and you can actually lay an angulator on the Earth and measure the angle between the two, and it would match what you see against the stars on the left. Incidentally, not all planetarium programs can do this, so you may, depending on the selection of software you got, set the planetarium scene for a particular date, capture that screen, and then turn on your solar system program, set it for the same date, capture that screen. And then in an image processor, you would just merge the two and put the solar system in a little box in one corner. The title bar at the top of the solar system panel in this scene comes from the program I used, which makes it a scalable, zoomable, and also movable. It's a floating pattern. So just mind that in your instance, if you want to make pictures like this, you may have to hopscotch between several programs. We move on to slide 7. Okay, so Jupiter and Saturn are in dim sky area, no bright stars in the vicinity, so there are no conjunctions with bright stars, and they don't conjunct with any other planet. Neptune and Uranus are off in the east, and we'll worry about them when we do our session on the autumn skies, and Venus and Mars too are way off in the west in the twilight. So they don't conjunct with any of the planets, they don't conjunct with any bright stars, and when the moon comes by, the moon is always a large gibbous or full moon, which, well, it's nice that they do that, but it's not as pretty as when you get the crescent moons when these planets are in the twilight or in the dawn sky in the morning. So the number of activities, events, is fairly small for both planets. We'll look at Saturn today. West quadrature is the time when Saturn rises at midnight. and therefore first enters view into the night sky. West Station is the entry of Saturn into his retrograde loop. That is, he stops moving eastward downrange in the zodiac, stops, pauses, that's the station, and then begins to run reverse against the signs westward. Then we have the opposition, when Saturn is in the middle of that retrograde loop. It's also closest to the Earth and is angularly moving fastest. We then have East Station, where it leaves the loop. Saturn slows down, stops, halts, and then resumes direct eastward motion. The East Quadrature is when Saturn in the sky sets around midnight and leaves a Saturnless sky until dawn. We have the same set of events for Jupiter, which we'll look at next time. Now, for Saturn, for both planets, I give the right ascension and declination where it is, and the distance from Earth, and the angular diameter. And we note that the Saturn remains about the same diameter throughout its apparition, at about the same distance away. They're so far from the Earth that the displacement of the Earth to and from as the Earth goes through her orbit is still a small fraction of the overall distance away. So unlike Venus, you don't get this enormous swing from a small round disk to a very large one. And similarly for Mars, you can get good views of Jupiter any time during its cycle around the zodiac, just so long as that it's in a reasonably dark sky away from the conjunction with the Sun. So we now move on to 8. Alright, here are very early diagrams by Galileo. And with the traditional symbols, you see that Jupiter was a ball, Mars was a ball, and we examined detail for Venus at the bottom, going through its phases and wide swing of size. But he had problems with Saturn. Don't forget, he had a crude telescope. He didn't build from scratch like a telescope maker today. He selected eyeglass lenses, had them up, you know, looking out the window kind of thing. Then he took a hunk of water pipe and fitted the lenses at each end. I think he had a sliding set. He asked his plumber to pick out two, one sliding and the other. That's how he could focus it. Even so, it was a pretty cruddy image. So he didn't really know what was going on with Saturn. No, it wasn't round, it had a cockeyed shape, and had like ears or handles or blobs or something. And so that puzzled him and many other astronomers who pretty quickly did get their own telescope. Now we see the conniption that early astronomers had with Saturn in slide 9. Okay, the upper left, picture 1, is what Galileo originally interpreted, that Saturn was actually 3 globes, a main one in the middle and 2 small ones on the side. But then he and other astronomers tried to interpret this with their crude telescopes, and gradually, but not quite, you see all the different ways they tried to configure Saturn into some kind of an intelligible model. I would say this, that this was complicated because Saturn's rings, as we explained, and we'll show you in the next picture, Saturn's rings appear to wobble from edge on to full open, that 27 degree tilt, and then back and forth, side to side. This was totally unknown. So when unknown to the astronomers, the rings tilted edge on, Saturn became just a single ball, and everyone went absolutely nuts. What happened to the appendages? Were they temporary? Were they flaws in the telescope? Were they imaginations by our previous expectations, or what? So here we see all the different ideas that were put out in that period 1610 to about 1650. In slide 10, we get the solution. Huygens, how you say it in English, remember New York City and Brooklyn have a very deep Dutch heritage. And so when we pronounce Dutch words, we're not claiming to be the same as they're pronounced in Holland, but it's a regional way of pronouncing those names. Anyway, Huygens is H-U-Y Yankee G-E-N-S, and however you want to pronounce it, no, you're on your own. Okay, he studied Saturn. By the 1650s, telescopes did improve, so you could get a sharper view, and he deduced that Saturn is surrounded by a flat ring, concentric on the ball, not touching it anywhere, and that ring was a fixed orientation in space against the stars. As Saturn goes around the Earth, the rings present more or less of their face to us, and sometimes having the rings edge on. So the inner circle of pictures shows Saturn as it trudges around in his orbit over a 30-year period. Now, from 1610 to the 1650s, Saturn went around a little more than once. So it was an accumulation of observations as well as the improvement in the instruments. The outer circle of pictures shows the scene seen through the telescope of the planet, and we see that it ranges from edge on, if you just go counterclockwise, edge on to full open, partial open, edge on, and so on. And this was an amazing revelation, and Huygens wrote a book, Saturnographica, that is the pictures or imaging of Saturn. It ended up being a whole discourse on what's going on with the planet. He also discovered the brightest moon, Titan. T for Tango I, T for Tango A, N. And we'll see him in a modern picture of Saturn. Now, I love this picture because it is so perfectly depicting the behavior of Saturn, and it's 350 years old. In slide 11, we have a modern version of the Huygens drawing, and the inner ring with Saturn, the edge on view is presented. That is, we're in deep space looking back into the solar system, and we're in an inertial frame so that we are standing in the edge plane of the rings. But the outer pictures show the view from Earth. And, well, in 2016, 2017, the rings were widest open, 27 degree tilt, and that's the right-hand view. We are kind of where the upper right picture is, with the rings less than that, around 20 degrees or so, or less. And then in 2024, 2025, we'll end up with an edge-on view. So roughly every 7.5 years, we make the transition full open to edge-on, and again 7.5 years, edge-on to full open. So a person who's been in astronomy for, well, 30 years, one cycle of Saturn, would have seen two edge-ons and two fully open views. And that's a well appreciable means of saying that when you show your neighbor Saturn, you try to explain these, you know, time spans and how long it takes things to, you know, transition in astronomy. And you may have had a drawing in your notebook in the old days, but here's what Saturn looked like way back in 2009, which would be the lowest seen here. See, the rings are almost edge-on, it's just a thin line. And you might even have a paper disc, say the base plate from a cake box, and hold that edge-on, it's a line. If you tilt it, it's an ellipse, and face-on, it's a circle. Well, we don't get the face-on view. 27 is it. It's the axial tilt of Saturn relative to his orbit, and the orbit itself is almost coincident with the ecliptic, so that it always stays near the ecliptic, and that's why the retrograde loops are a swaying back and forth. I'll throw in an interesting bit of history from my cockeyed past. I studied hieroglyphs. That's a story and a half. I'll do a lesson on that, but you'll need 4 or 5 hours to while away. Maybe I'll skip that. Anyway, while studying hieroglyphs, you had to learn vocabulary, and the phrase that denotes a planet in the sky is the star with no rest, or sometimes the star always moving, to represent that it is a star, but instead of being fixed in a constellation, it meanders. And the glyph that represented the goddess or goddess that, you know, lives in that planet is shown on a raft or a float, representing the idea that it sways back and forth the way a raft would in the Nile River, as the currents or the waves make it bob back and forth. So we'll move on to slide 12. Holy Toledo, and Cleveland, and Cincinnati, and Columbus, and Marion. This is Saturn. Now, in any ordinary scope, it would be physically smaller, but as long as the optics are good and the air is steady, you're going to see that without the labels. You'll see the ball, which is yellowish, and the rings, which would be white, or in some telescopes, bluish. And it has a wow factor like no other planet can offer. One thing I've noticed, I'll throw this out for you who do public star viewing. I can appreciate, because I've done this myself, you're out in the open field or in a park, and there's no handy electric to plug in your clock drives. And if you have one of those battery-powered telescopes, you'll run out your batteries after about a half hour of showing Saturn to your telescope. So the planet will drift, and you have to continually manipulate the axes to get the planet back in view. So a way of minimizing this is you use low power, so it just takes longer to fly through the eyepiece view. So maybe 2 or 3 people get a look, and then you got to jump in and recenter. Actually, you put it near the trailing side of the eyepiece so that it flows through to the center and then out. I mean, I appreciate you doing that, but what happens is many people pout, oh, but why is it so small? I see a little ball, and is that a hoop? Or is that like ears? So many people won't immediately see the ring first glance. So do try as best as you can cope, jack up the power so it becomes an obvious ring. Okay, there are three rings we can see with home telescopes from the ground. The outer one is A, then there's a gap, a pretty considerable one, and then there's ring B. And if you have a larger scope, somewhat keen eyesight, and really clear skies, you see a very gossamer, gauzy fringe inside ring B. That's ring C for Charlie, or the gauze or crepe ring. If you think of that construction paper you played with in school, or even do arts and crafts with, which has a rubbery cloth texture, and it's called crepe paper. So that's the ring. You can see through it, so it only shows on a really clear sky and with a larger scope. So most of us would be satisfied with the A and B ring. Separating those two is Cassini division, discovered by the 1600s astronomer, not the space probe of the 21st century. There's a thin ring at the edge of the A ring, which a large scope will show, discovered in the 1800s by Encke, which is, well, Encke's division. The ball, on the other hand, is pretty bland and featureless. You get some weak cloud belts with parallel to the equatorial and ring plane, and occasionally you get some white spots. They come and go every couple of years. An interesting feature, near the quadrature dates, when the sun is shining on Saturn at a steep angle to our line of sight, we get phasing where the averted side, that is the side opposite to where the sun is, shows a little shading, and we can get a hint of the shadow of the planet on the ring behind it, which are very fascinating picture to take. By the way, in chemophotography, Saturn was really, and Mars, were the toughest planets to get a good picture. We see this scene in the telescope, you mount up the camera, you crank the film, you check the settings on the dials, and you look in the viewfinder, you focus as best as you can, and you shear the scope from wind, you stand very still, you got the shutter release, you take your picture, and then when you get your picture back a week later, because you have to process the film, and you see this blurry mush, as if you took a cardboard cutout and you viewed it through, say, a bathroom window. So it's really tough to get good pictures. In digital pictures, and especially if you have a video camera, you can get very pleasing pictures. In a still camera, take the picture, look at the scene, in review, and so then you just go take another right there on the spot. But that is Saturn's ball and rings. Okay, slide 12. You take a zoomed out view to pick up the moons of Saturn. Now the moons of Saturn are pretty faint, about 10th magnitude. So while they're visible in a modest sized telescope, I suggest 15 cent as a minimum, although many people do pick them up in a dark sky with a 10 cent telescope. I'm referring, of course, to the diameter of the aperture, not the cost. The brightest of the moon, the one which is obvious in almost any telescope, is like a 2 o'clock from Saturn in this scene, is Titan, the largest of the moons, by far the largest. All the others are pretty small. And it, for a long time, was believed to be the largest moon in the solar system. That's the way I grew up with Saturn. Now I find Ganymede is a trifle bigger, but it's a mean-sized moon anyway, kind of like the size of Mercury, but that's that Titan. Some observers tell me that they can see the orange color. I never did. It's just a white dot. But it's the obvious moon. Huygens discovered it, and then other astronomers in the 16, 1700s found the others. And I remember vividly in the 1960s, the 10th moon was found, Janus, J-A-N-U-S. And that was a big sensation because it required, I forget the observatory, a large observatory, deep photography, careful scrutiny under a microscope, and so on, to realize that that little pinprick on film moved in orbit motion around Saturn. So Saturn had 9 moons classically in all my old books, 10 in the newer ones, and then when the space probes got there, the number of moons exploded. But these here are about the ones that you can see in the small scope. There are a couple of others which will make up the 9 in the classical set, and we also made a game of it, who can name them all. And I remember when I was a child going to the Hayden Planetarium, and I forget what the show was, but probably was Saturn or maybe the outer planets or some conjunction of Saturn or something, and the lecturer said, you know, as a joke, Saturn has 9 planets, and I bet none of you can name them. And so I whispered out, Titan, Rhea, Tethys, Dione, and the whole audience cracked up. I did get them all. Okay. You liked that, didn't you? Okay, you in the blue chest. Yeah, you like that. Okay. Stamp your feet. Okay. All right. Okay, that's enough. We'll go on to the next slide, the 14. The inner moons, the ones that we can see in small scopes, are in the ring and equatorial plane of Saturn and are concentric with the rings. So to look for a particular moon, we would have to look along one of the orbits for the moon. There's one that's off at an angle, that's one of the outer moons. The outer moons, including the ones that, you know, all the new ones, are so far away from the planet, and we'll see this for Jupiter in spades, are so far from the planet that they are not really held as tightly to the planet by Saturn's own gravity, but they're pulled hither thither by Jupiter's gravity and also the Sun. Indeed, their orbits cannot be predicted by ordinary algorithms and formulae. I can't take an equation, plug in a date, and then that's the radiocession, declination, or XY position of the moon relative to Saturn. We can't do that. What we have to do is start from some known measured position and use a good solar system modeler that has real gravity embedded in the planets, and then let gravity do its thing day by day, week by week, until we reach the date that we were looking for, stop, and then measure either in the print, in the recorded log, or even measuring directly off the computer screen where that moon is. Those orbits are called, in mathematical terms, chaotic. Now, in this particular program, when you fire it up, the inner moons with deterministic orbits are calculated for the date the program fires up. Here's the system time. The outer moons are put at a arbitrary starting, I think it's the date that the program was published, and their motions then after are flowing by gravity of the Sun, Jupiter, and Saturn, but they will not be the actual places relative to the inner moon. So that program should be used for illustrating chaotic behavior rather than actually Bohr sighting on that spot in the sky and hoping to see the moon. We move to slide 15. Well, we spoke of the tilt of the rings. They're remembering that it's just that Saturn is walking around the Sun and is exposing more or less of the rings to us. So we have there on the left the last full open view, and then we have the last edge on view. Now, this is a freak out. When the edges, the rings are edge on, they are gone. Their thickness is only a few tens of meters, maybe 100 meters, and there's no way you can see that in a small telescope. So the planet looks like a bald globe. There's a very hilarious story I could tell you. For the 1980 go around with the edge-on view of Saturn's rings, one of our club members had recently acquired a small telescope, nothing special, but you know, it was competent, you know, you see the planets, and the instructions said that you could see the rings of Saturn and the moons of Jupiter. So he takes it out, you know, he unwraps it all, his father helps get it together, and he goes outside and loses a star. Okay, that's Saturn. He looks at Saturn and he sees the scene on the right. And as hard as he could look and carefully focus, all he got was that little ball, no rings. Well, it's a cheap scope. Then he said, well, there's Jupiter. So they aim it at Jupiter. And the scene he saw was like the one on the right. Just the ball. Oh, he saw some of the belts and some texture. No moons. Well, the club meeting is coming up, so he comes to the club meeting and he complains and says, what's going on? Now, we knew about the edge-on view of Saturn's ring, so we had a good laugh on him because he happened to be watching during the days when the edge-on phase was occurring. The Jupiter scene stumped us until someone pulled out Astronomy Magazine or some such and looked at the diagram where the moons are day by day, and on the day he went out, all of the moons were either in front of or behind the planet, not off to the side. See, so we congratulated him for seeing a very rare event, for the next go-around with the edge-on view would be in the year 2000-2001. 2003, something like that. And 1995, we get the next edge on, so we told him to stay in astronomy for that and go out and look at Jupiter tonight when you get home, and you'll see the moons all over the place on Jupiter. But up to a week before the actual edge on, you do see the ring as a hairline dart through the planet And starting a week or so afterwards, you start to see that hairline dart again. And thereafter, the line gets a little thicker and thicker, and its stature is in the sky as long enough, depending on the apparition it's in, you see an obvious line running through the planet. And then the next cycle of Saturn in the night sky, you can definitely see that as a thin ring with a definite cut, you know, between the planet and the ring. But those are the two extremes for the edge-on and full open position. And the next slide, 16, not only do the rings come edge-on and then open up again, they flip sides. So there in 2022, which is how we'll see the rings next year, if you're looking at Saturn now, next year the rings will be a little flatter, and flatter still in 2023. And in 2024 through 2025, they'll be edge-on. What we are seeing on Saturn now, 2021 and so on, is the north face. When the rings go edge on and then start to open, we flip side because the Earth is passing through the opposite hemisphere. And then on, this 2028, we will see the south side of the planets. And unlike Jupiter, which we'll see next time, the two hemispheres of the globe are pretty much the same. So the same weak texture and the same occasional spots will be seen there as we are seeing them now on the north side. So it's not that the rings fold up, then flap back up. They fold up and continue to show the other side. Again, if you have a flat cardboard disc, such as some appliances or conveniences with as a round shape, some of the packing material may be a disc for cushioning or centering the device in its carton. Or if you really want to be, you know, have some fun, go buy yourself a boxed cake and then eat the cake, wash off the disc at the bottom, and there you have your little demonstration for Saturn's rings. Moving on to 17. Okay, Jupiter and Saturn were not conjunct with other planets for a while. In the spring of 2022, we'll get some conjunctions with Venus in the morning sky. But for the rest of this year's apparition, they stand alone with no bright stars or planets to conjunct with. But last year in December, in time for the year-end holidays, Jupiter was conjuncting with Saturn so closely that to casual sight, it looked like they merged into a single dot. And that's the scene at the closest, the actual geometric conjunction on the 21st of December. And we had Mensa Mensa weather, but because Jupiter and Saturn are so bright, even with clouds around it, it made a very pretty scene. This is a computer simulation. It's pretty realistic. You got the sunset glow behind that big bush in the lower left, and your twilight glow above it. But that is what happened. Now, several sessions ago, we had a question, when will it happen again? Well, 2040 is the next time we will have the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn. And some of us old dogs remember previous ones, my own first in 1960, then 1980, 1981, and then 2000, 2001, and then the 2021 last year. So that also is a way to cut notches in your telescope tripod leg for how long you've been in astronomy. That's the naked eye view. And slide 18, shows the binocular view in the lower left. That's a simulation too. But that's what it looks like in binoculars, with two stars side by side. If you held the binoculars steadily, and bearing in mind that both planets are on the yonder side of the sun, you maybe will see Jupiter as a fat star, not quite an actual point. And Saturn possibly may look a little elongated, but to me with binoculars, they were just two bright stars side by side. The upper one is a photograph borrowed and then annotated by the author, showing the telescopic view. The two planets fit in the same low-power eyepiece field. Unfortunately, we were in deep lockdown and probably only clandestine underground gatherings of us astronomers at private houses could enjoy that view. The picture is good enough to show some of the moons of Jupiter. The moons of Jupiter are bright enough. You should see them in binoculars, but most of us will miss them or treat them as nearby stars, they're angrily close stars. And some people with very sharp eyesight claim to see them by eye. Now, the ancients supposedly saw them, but they would not recognize them as satellites of Jupiter. They were just field stars that Jupiter was passing by. Look at slide 19. We'll be coming to the end of the lesson. This is the last segment, about three slides left. This time I did count carefully. All right. The rings are made of individual rocks and boulders, chunks of ice and whatever, and they're very irregularly shaped, so they have deep shadow, crevasses in them, holes in them, and they cast their shadow on adjacent rocks. So the frontal geometrical area, or the projected area, does not fully reflect light to us. You think of the moon. When we see the moon in a crescent, the full illuminated area of the moon is flecked with dark spots, which are the deep areas inside craters, the shadows of mountains on the land around it, the dark side of those mountains, and so on. So the actual square kilometers that are reflecting light to us is rather less than the geometric fraction illuminated globe of the moon. So the moon appears far less bright than it should by its geometry. The same thing happens with the rings of Saturn. When we see the rings, we're looking at all those rocks, but what looks like a beautiful clean sheet is actually a matrix of infinitesimally small cells of light and dark spots, the shadows, or even rocks hidden behind others and therefore can't reflect light to us. And so the rings normally have a lesser illumination than what their angular area would suggest. Slide 20. All right, this is a bizarre effect. I myself have never seen this, and that's because when I see Saturn, it's once in a while during its apparition, and I don't really keep records of how bright it looks. The picture on the left was taken by the author, somebody else, HST. Can't get a better author than that. The slide there shows Saturn just after this year's opposition, August 5th, and the one on the right many days later, last week. If you look, if you sit back, oh, maybe a meter from the screen, the rings on the left seem brighter against the planet ball than the ones on the left. This effect was discovered by Seeliger, S-E-E-L-I-G-E-R, in the early 20th century, and he explained it by that light and shadow effect which you saw in the previous picture. We by then determined that the rings were made of individual rocks, each being actual satellite in its own orbit around Saturn, which leads to the very juvenile question, how many moons does Saturn have? Okay, it has 9 moons, 10 moons, 64 moons. Oh, no, you're wrong. All right, how many moons? Squillions and squillions. Oh, well, because he's counting each particle in the ring. See, but conventionally, we count as a moon a discrete, independent, autonomous, self-standing rock, even if it is only a few hundred meter diameter, but not packed together, moving as a flock like those within the ring. So Jupiter, which has rings, by the way, and Saturn have a countable number of discrete, distinct moons, plus an innumerable number of particles in the ring. So Seeliger noted that when the rings when at opposition, the sun is shining face onto the rings, the shaded side of the rocks are behind the rock, and any shadows that is casting onto other rocks are hidden by the first rock. So the entire frontal area of the ring is reflecting light to us, so we get an enhanced illumination. Many days later, not all that many, the shadows start to creep into view and the shaded side of the rocks start coming into view, and they take away area that could be illuminating us but now are dark, and the rings subside to their normal brightness. This is sometimes called ring flash, F-L-A-S-H. We don't mean that you go out on the night of opposition, look at your watch, okay, 23:23 Pacific Daylight Savings Time. Oh wow, it flashed! No, that does not happen. The only way you recognize it is if you observe Saturn for a week or so, day by day, as weather permits, through opposition and afterwards. Digital imaging makes it somewhat easier, and you may want to try this exercise for yourself. Okay? With this picture, this is not a quiz, this is something to do for yourself. If you, there was a quiz, I'll come back to it at the end of the lesson. The, bring this picture into an image editor. Take a 9x9 cell, pixel cell, on the ball and on the ring in the left-hand picture. Add the pixel count for both cells, and you divide the ball pixel count into the ring pixel count. So you're going to get a value brighter than one. Do the same for the right-hand picture using the same part of the ball and the same part of the ring. Again, take the ratio, and it'll be a little bigger than one. It should be a smaller ratio than for the left-hand picture, shown that the rings are a little brighter. The effect can be subtle, but with digital imaging, home astronomers can demonstrate it. So if you pretend that a friend gave you these pictures, as was passed along to me for this lesson, you can demonstrate it for yourself. However, if this fails you or is not convincing for you, take a look at slide 21, which is next to the last, not quite the next to the last slide. You can see the Seeliger effect anytime you want by looking at your own shadow on the ground. It works best if the ground is dusty or has short foliage, grass, let's say. It also works on some kinds of concrete, which is a, say, clinker rather than smooth, you know, travel that smooth. Sidewalks don't do too well. But maybe another way is if you go to a demolition or construction site and filch a hunk of busted up concrete, as long as roughly smooth, that is not a lump but a plate with a rough surface, and you can hold that on the ground and cast your shadow on it. You see this fellow here, there's a glow around his head. He held the camera up and took a picture. It's the same effect. The terrain is made of little elements that have shade behind it or shadow onto other elements and therefore have a certain brilliance. But when you look at it with the sun shining straight onto it, which is where your head in the shadow is, you end up with only the sunlight front sides of the dust particles or grass blades shine. Because all the shadows are hidden, you get an enhanced bright reflection. That's called the Gloria. G-L-O-R-I-A, or glory, G-L-O-R-Y, either way. And it's an optical effect. It's pretty common. We see it all the time, but most of us don't recognize it. But when one day, by chance, or someone points it out to you, you took a picture of a scene, and you get the picture, oh, this is ruined, I got my shadow in it. Hey, wait a minute, what's that bright thing around my head? I didn't see that. And if it's a place where you can go back to, like someplace in your neighborhood, you go there, and it astounds people that everyone has his own glory. Now, if there were other people side by side, only you have the glory. The picture next, the guy next to you takes a picture also. His shadow has the glory, not yours. Again, the dust or the grass to the right or to the left have some shade. In fact, if you were to zoom in, you'll see a rather variegated textured appearance to the ground, whereas just around the shadow of the head is very smooth because there are no shadows to give you that chiaroscuro texture. Now, the last slide, which would conclude our lesson, is the mother of all glories. And you may have seen it without realizing what it was. So the very next time you take an airline flight, look for it. And that'd be in slide 22. Mamma mia! That is the shadow of an airplane. I forget which flight. It doesn't matter to me. This is a borrowed picture, but I have some of my own in chemo film form. The glory around it comes from the fact that the ground, even the cloud, which is made of water droplets, behind it. Well, that's a bad example. It's on the ground, like snow maybe. Any case, as the plane moves over the ground, that glory grows and shrinks according as the terrain under it. For instance, under ocean or open water, you don't see it. Under snow or icy clouds, it's extra enhanced, not because of the shadow effect, but because the droplets inside have, and the ice crystals do have mirror-like reflection. The same phenomena that causes, say, solar halos. But on dry ground, that is what you see. And as the airplane turns, of course, you see the thing tilting and moving, and you have to maybe switch sides to the shade side to look down at the ground and get it. Again, when we go on an eclipse or other astronomy-related travel trip by air, we all know about this. Of course, the crew on the plane has no idea what we're doing because we're all out of our seats looking on the shady side, and then we point out to the cabin attendants the glory around your plane, and sometimes we joke about, say, this is a special excursion flight, so that's why it has the glory around it. But others say, yeah, we're teasing you, stewardess, you just had, too many drinks, that's why you're seeing that. But that does conclude our lesson for Saturn. It's up there in the evening at nightfall. If it be clear tonight, get out there and look. It, with Jupiter, will be in the southeast at nightfall, moving to the south later on, like later September, and then by the, as autumn moves along, it will be in the southwest, and then it will disappear into twilight by year end and going into January. That's our lesson for today. The third in our series for the planets will be next time, September 3rd, which will cover Jupiter, and that will be a whole order more exciting because the planet itself is more exciting. Now we go on to our quiz. Okay, go back to slide 11 or slide 10, but 11 will be a bit easier to understand. You have there Saturn going round and round the Sun and oscillating between edge-on and fully open. When Galileo saw the rings of Saturn, not knowing what they were, the planet had open rings. People debunked him. Well, he was a guinea, you know how they are, you know. Anyway, the argument was, when others tried to duplicate his work by 1612, they just saw a single ball, no funny ears or handles, and says, no, Saturn's just like any other kind of planet. You didn't know what you were looking at. You're drinking too much grog. So by the time Huygens worked out the true nature of the rings, Saturn went through edge-on and full-open over roughly a 50-year period, 1610 to 1655 or so. The quiz question is, in what year, maybe even to the month if you can, in what years in that span were the rings edge-on, and when were they fully open, 27-something degree tilt? And that will help you appreciate why it took so long to figure out what was going on with the rings. The rings kept disappearing in a manner which was utterly unimaginable in a 1600s concept of worlds out there beyond Earth. And so, until next time, pray for clear skies.